Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Claire Roth, in for Ann today. It's Chefs in the City, and joining me is co-host Steve Stover. Thanks so much for being here, Steve.
Good morning. Yes, how are you, Claire?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good.
The Art of French Cooking advises that wine makes a symphony of a meal, and we are here to talk about that sort of symphonic pairing today, here to help us understand the nuances of a good food-wine pairing. Our sommelier at Veritas, Gregory Stokes, welcome.
Welcome. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And chef owner Joshua Dalton, thank you so much for joining us, Josh.
Thank you for having me, too.
So before we talk about wine, congratulations are in order. Just a few weeks ago, Columbus Monthly named Veritas the number one restaurant in Columbus for the fourth time.
It was a pleasure.
Yeah, congratulations. Absolutely.
Thank you.
So tell us a little bit about what Veritas has been doing lately. How did you earn that distinction?
Oh, I don't know. Hopefully good food and lots of wine. Lots of wine makes everything taste better. So
very, very true.
That doesn't hurt. Yeah, we've been in our new home almost 2 years now. We were originally located in Delaware. We opened in 2011, so it's been open almost 7 years, and it's been a fun ride.
Yeah, so tell us about when it started in Delaware. You know, why start a restaurant? Why start one there? What was the ethos behind it?
So I own a restaurant in Delaware called 1808 American Bistro. And it kind of covers a wide variety of food. And we opened up Veritas just as a playground for some of the other chefs that worked with me. We wanted to kind of get out of the box and push the envelope a little bit. So it was more of a place where we could cook the food that we really were interested in.
And it was and continues to be the most innovative restaurant in Central Ohio. And I think that's what makes it stand out. Since the very beginning, you know, they were a little edgy and trying all kinds of wonderful combinations and presentations of food. And I think that's what was in part responsible for their move up to the top.
Well, and not to put you on the spot, but give us an example of that innovation. You know, for those of us who have never dined there, what's something that, as Steve says, sets you apart in this kind of exciting new way?
I think when we first opened, we were a lot younger. We had a good crew. We had Silas Caton. We also had Avishar Barua. And they're two prominent chefs in Columbus. But we were all really young, and I think we got associated really quickly with that modernist gastronomy kind of label to us. And I think at the beginning, you saw a lot of that in the food. And as we've gotten older and I think we've refined it, we still use some of those techniques, but you don't see them quite as much.
Can you give an example of a technique for those of us who might not know what modernist gastronomy is?
It's just more manipulation of the food, you know, taking an olive oil and turning it into a powder, mm-hmm. or taking liquid and turn it into a gel so it sits up really pretty on the plate.
Using liquid nitrogen.
Yes. Also known as molecular gastronomy, mm-hmm. in some ways. But the original was Veritas was very casual. It had mostly high top tables and it was a very small room. The new one is more of a sit down restaurant. Mm-hmm. And I think when it opened, it was all the small plates and things like that. But they've also instituted a tasting menu, which has been very popular.
Tell us about that.
So the tasting menu is kind of something that we like to do. I think as chefs, it gives us you cook in the seasons. You also cook things that you're really excited about. I think in today's society, you're so busy every minute. It's almost like we're – I do have ADD, but I think everybody else is getting it as well with Instagram and Facebook. And everybody has so much going on. It's nice to sit back and let the diners and our guests take a load off and let us do the work and let us do the thinking and for people to really enjoy their company that they're with.
It's the greatest social convention, having friends and family sit down together at a table and enjoy food and wine.
Yeah.
And make an evening of it. That's the great part about the tasting menus.
Yeah, absolutely. You moved here, you said, 2 years ago. How has that change in location treated you? Do you feel like there was a big shift when you came here in more than just, you know, the space itself?
Yeah. So we had a really good opportunity to move downtown. Edwards Communities has been very generous to us with the move downtown. I will say downtown it's very trying.
Yeah. We've heard a lot about that on this show itself, about how hard it is to make it in the downtown scene.
At 4 o'clock is a mass exodus out of town as fast as they can get out. And I think in the next 2-3 years, as downtown becomes more of a community, I think it's going to be something that turns into something really special. But the transition has been a little difficult. Mm-hmm. The space is beautiful. You know, the upstairs bar is stunning. I think it's probably one of the best rooms in Columbus.
And that's the Citizens Trust, correct?
Correct. Mm-hmm. And Logan does a great job up there. You know,
that's your bar, the manager and the
upstairs, yeah. And the upstairs and downstairs has a completely two different feels. The idea is you could spend your whole evening with us. You can come downstairs, do a tasting menu, drink some good wine, go upstairs, have some innovative cocktails in a beautiful space where it's a lot more chill and relaxed.
Well, and Citizens Trust is really unique because it's an old bank that's been retrofitted as a bar. I mean, I've never seen anything like it as a patron.
Oh, but
you've
been there, huh?
Oh, I've absolutely been there.
Been to the bar.
Oh, there have
the
been
bar,
many evenings.
Just saying.
Yeah, not to Veritas, but
it's
upstairs.
Not only one of the most spectacular rooms in Columbus. I describe it as one of the most spectacular rooms in the Midwest when I did my review about a year ago. And it's just huge and remarkable and beautiful. And then to go downstairs in the more intimate, but it still has a casual feel. Is that's fair to say, the dining room?
Oh, I think so.
Really? You don't think of that when you think of fine dining.
I think this is more of a Midwestern thing. I don't care what you wear. As long as you're here to have good food and drink some wine and enjoy yourself.
No jacket requirements.
No, absolutely not.
Go ahead.
I feel like it's a pretty casual. It's definitely a little bit more upscale than the original Veritas. And I love that space. The old Veritas has a magical space. We have a new restaurant in that one called Spec. And it's
out in Delaware.
Yep. And the moment you walk in, you just feel warm and cozy. And trying to recreate that downtown, it definitely has a different feel. But I still think it's warm and intimate.
And stylish.
Yeah.
I feel very grown up when I go in there. So,
well, and that retrofitting is so interesting to me because in so many ways it's indicative of some of the problems you're talking about, right? Where now there's no longer a bank there, so a restaurant moves in, but you feel like downtown is about to kind of explode in a sort of community sense. Do you think it's all the residential spaces that are moving down there? What gives you that hope?
Well, the amount of apartments definitely, or condos are coming downtown, definitely are. I think in the next few years, as we get more, you know, it needs a grocery store, it needs a flower shop, it needs things that make communities, more little independent boutique retailers would be beautiful, and hopefully those things come.
And there's also construction. That's another thing that's been a problem. You've got a little boutique jewelry store across the street, and you've got the North Market, but I was just driving by this week, and there's something going on out in front.
Yeah, and there's always construction. Every day there's a new road closed.
Yeah. I think everyone in Columbus is frustrated by that, but most people, it won't affect their business.
Yeah.
So that must be difficult.
Yeah, we're banking on downtown being the next hot spot.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a few other people that are banking on it too. So,
and I think all the national press that Columbus has gotten in the last year, 3 articles in the New York Times and Food and Wine magazine talking about the Columbus food scene. It's an emerging and a very important food scene, and I think that's going to be great, good for everybody.
When you look at that, you look at that concept that Steve's talking about, where we're really being seen as a star, especially in the middle of the country, why do you think that is? What do you think allowed for so many restaurants, so many innovators like yourself to really make this their culinary home?
Well, that's a good question. Do you have anything, Greg?
I think that one of the great things about Columbus is because it's so close to so many amazing food and wine scenes. I mean, it's a 5-hour drive to Chicago. You can get to Louisville. You can get to Nashville. You can get to Pittsburgh. And I think that a lot of people who are inspired to want to do something more have really great reference points to be inspired by.
That's a really interesting concept.
And I think in the last 15 years, Columbus has emerged. We started with Hankey's and Rigsby's and Lantibe and Rosendale's. And then we had the downturn and we lost them between then and 2015. But the young entrepreneurs and chefs have brought Columbus, taken Columbus to a new but different level. I do think that Columbus is really highly regarded, clearly the best food city in Ohio, in my opinion. And it has been for actually 10 or 15 years.
When you look at it, where do you think it's going next? I mean, you talk about those young people coming in and shaping it. How would you describe what that is?
The biggest trend I see in the whole world is the decline of fine dining and the emergence of young chefs, chef-owned restaurants, sometimes, in fact, many times with multiple locations. Again, far more casual, no white tablecloths. And I think that's what we're seeing in Columbus. But you see the same thing in Paris, where some of the chefs open two or three places and they're casual. Daniel Rose and several expat Americans, the people who own Verjus. And so, I mean, I think you're at Veritas is really at the lead of that emergence.
Well, and Greg, I'm interested. You know, we most associate sommeliers with fine dining, with white tablecloths. What do you think the place of a sommelier is as we are seeing this kind of new era in how people spend their money on food?
Well, I think that, you know, obviously sommelier started in the fine dining community, but I think really what we do as a profession, and I think that sommeliers in general, we're trying to reinvent ourselves as well, is really almost no restaurant can really afford to have like a full-time sommelier. So what is our job? Our job is really to help people find wines that they're going to love. I mean, I think there's never been a better time to be a wine drinker. There is so much amazing wine out there that, to be honest, there's almost too much. And there's so much wine out there. Who knows what's good? And so it's kind of really the sommelier's job is like to be your friend and tell you, hey, I think since you like this, you should like that. And so I think that in a way, even though almost no restaurant has dedicated sommeliers anymore, there's never been a more important time to have it because there's just so many choices and options.
Well, and we are going to talk all about those choices and options coming up in just a moment on All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Chefs in the City today. With me, as always, Steve Stover, WOSU food critic and co-host, and our guests this hour, both from Veritas, chef and owner Josh Dalton, and the manager and sommelier Gregory Stokes. We will be back in just a few minutes. If you have a favorite place to get wine and food in the city, if you have a favorite wine pairing that's your go-to, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org.
Support for the All Sides with Ann Fisher podcast comes from Wolf's Ridge Brewing, a family-owned downtown Columbus restaurant, taproom, and brewery, showcasing seasonal menus and more than 20 Wolf's Ridge beers on draft. Learn more at wolfsridgebrewing.com.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Claire Roth, in for Ann Fisher today. Ben Franklin once said, "Wine is constant proof that God loves us and loves to see us happy." And chefs around Columbus are taking that to heart as they provide wine and food pairings. It's Chefs in the City today, and we are talking about those pairings, what to consider, and how to choose the beverage that accompanies your meal. With me is Chefs in the City co-host Steve Stover. Thanks so much for being here, Steve.
Thank you.
And still with us are our guests, chef and owner of Veritas, Joshua Dalton, and the sommelier there, Gregory Stokes. Thank you both for staying with us today.
Our pleasure.
So we were talking about the tasting menu earlier that happens at Veritas. You also have paired wines that you can get with that, correct?
We do.
Tell us about that. How do you do that?
I think that's really the most fun part of my job is really trying to react to, I think, just some innovative and exciting cuisine and trying to figure out the best ways to highlight and enhance it. So I'm really lucky to work with in such a great format. for me, for how the pairings work, I mean, I guess there's different ways you can look at how to do a wine pairing. First rule is always just drink what you like. But
that's a good rule. That's a good rule for all of us, I think.
Absolutely. I think that, again,
don't force yourself to drink something that you will hate.
100%. I think that, you know, wine just has so much of this like cultural weightiness to it that people get intimidated. And it's really our job in the restaurant community to really kind of take the pretension out of it. And just like it's a beverage. It should be fun. It's supposed to be delicious. So just let it be that.
So after that, what do you think about? I mean, I think we all know you white with fish or chicken, red with steak. But can you go beyond that? What do you think about? What are your kind of guiding lights?
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, it's kind of Veritas gives me the freedom to kind of play. And, you know, there are those expectations like white wine with fish. And sometimes we like to turn them on their head. And sometimes we do white wine with steak and red wine with fish. But so there's really like there's a few different ways that you can do it.
Champagne with everything.
Champagne with everything always.
That's Josh's mantra.
Yeah. I think that was when
we don't have any right now.
I think that was when I decided I wanted to work for Josh is when he actually said that. I was like, I agree with you.
If we'd only known, we could have popped some today.
I know. Well, it makes everything a celebration. So when you say there's a couple ways to think about it, give us one.
Yeah, so the really quick and easy way to think about how to do a wine pairing that's always going to be successful is there's this old saying, what grows together goes together. So in the region of Sancerre in France, it's where you find the fantastic Chèvre goat cheeses. So it just so happens that the food that they make there goes really well with the wine that they also make there. So if you're wondering what should pair with goat cheese, it's Sauvignon Blanc from Sancerre.
Interesting.
So that's like there's always like that. I think that in those older cultures, they have that little bit of, hey, this is our cuisine and we happen to make a wine that goes really well with our food.
Yeah, so, it's gone together for hundreds of years. Don't change the feed on a winning horse.
Exactly. There's another way that I've seen people do it, which is, you know, just to try to do like flavor based pairings. So like I like fish and I like to squeeze lemon on my fish. So maybe if I find a white wine that tastes like lemon, I can drink it with the fish and it's delicious. But then really kind of where I start off with trying to figure out how to work with Josh's cooking is what I call structural pairings.
What does that mean?
So, well, I guess it would help if we talked a couple of terms. So one of the things that I'll say is like, well, acid and tannin. Acid is basically the thing that makes your mouth water. So if you bite into a lemon and your mouth waters, that's acidity. Tannin is that sensation of your mouth drying out, like if you bit into a tea leaf.
Walnuts.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dry red wine.
Yeah.
And a dry red wine.
So once you kind of understand, you know, how those things work, so, okay, you want a wine that is at least as acidic as the dish. You want a wine that is at least as sweet as the dish. Because if the dish is more acidic than the wine, it'll make the wine taste metallic. If you choose a really tannic wine with lots of alcohol, like a big Cabernet Sauvignon, and you're to put it with super spicy food, that alcohol will make the spice actually stand out more and your mouth just keeps burning. And so it's really just trying to find, again, almost like that squeeze of lemon on a fish principle. Mm-hmm. You're trying to find like use wine almost like salt and pepper on a dish and try to kind of elevate that dish and kind of I come from a musical background. My parents were both musicians. And so sometimes I like to think about layers of flavor almost like, you know, in music, you know, there's the bass, there's the drum, there's the melody and the harmony on top. And I try to think about using wine to figure out where I think there's the empty space in the dish and try to fill that.
That's really fascinating because it's not just them being complementary and it's not just them being opposites. It's finding, I don't even want to say a happy medium, but somewhere where it can bring out the best in each other, like putting a good outfit together, for instance, or I guess a good relationship.
Yeah, to me, a perfect pairing. And it's so hard to do. And I'm not always successful at it, but I always have this memory. Like the first time somebody gave me this white wine and I said, oh, that wine is nice. And then they gave me this bite of cheese and I said, okay, now try them together. And it was this synergy where the sum was greater than the whole. And that just blew my mind. And I think ever since then, I've kind of been trying to, you know, chase that dragon. and that's kind of what we try to do at Veritas is really kind of figure out how to – like the food is already just so amazing. And obviously we have we're privileged and have access to some of the best wines in the world, but it's how to make them both play in unison as opposed to one dominating the
other. Do you guys play in unison in designing the food and the wine together? Do you talk about that?
I think the beautiful thing about having a professional on that side of things is I kind of get to create the dish, or my team will create the dish, and then it's kind of on his shoulders to make sure he finds something that goes with it. And the beautiful thing about the wine world right now, I mean, there's so much out there and there's so many new regions, and you no longer have to drink Napa or Bordeaux. You know, he's pulling wines from South Africa and Lebanon. And
it must be grueling to have to taste all that wine, Greg.
Well, funny enough, it kind of feels that way sometimes, but I'm super privileged, right? You know, it's like first world problems where, you know, at the end of the day I said, oh my gosh, I've had too much wine. I need to have a beer.
Cleanse your palate in a way.
Yeah. No, I think it's fantastic. It's really, for me, again, my job is, one, to find wines that people are going to love, but really – I work at a chef-owned and driven restaurant. My job is really to just emphasize what they're doing. So it's a little much more like I kind of react to what they do. But then again, we do also do wine dinners where maybe I find a winery I'm super pumped about, and then it's really exciting to kind of pour the wines for all the cooks and the chefs and say, hey, this is what I think could go with it, and then watch just their creative gears turn. Like, I'm not a chef. I'm not the creative one. I'm more like the curator, right?
Well, I think there's a certain creativity that comes with that as well, but
sure.
I'll let it sit. Something that Joshua said that interested me was the concept that there are so many more out there. Is that true in your experience, that we have a wider range of wines to choose from in this day and age than we have in the past?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's never been a better time to be a wine drinker.
Yeah, he buys a lot of wine. I know that much.
Ask Mrs. Stover.
Is it that the industry's exploded? Is that what's allowed for that sort of variety? Or
yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it was funny. Somebody showed me a wine list the other day from 1952. And if you read it, there is basically just Bordeaux, Burgundy, Champagne, maybe a Sancerre, and then some German Riesling, and that was it. And now you can walk into a restaurant and look. Walk into our restaurant and sure, there's wines from Israel and Lebanon. And I think that's, you know, starting in the 1970s, really people just kind of all around the world said, oh, you know what? It doesn't have to come from France to be good. And so all these different countries finally like, you know what? We're going to celebrate what we can do. Mm-hmm. And with the opening of global trade, now you can basically buy anything you want.
Wow. So we've been talking about you creating a paired menu, which is obviously a lot of forethought. There's a lot of upfront work there. You've got time. What about when someone comes in to order, you know, one dish? How do you help them choose what goes with their meal kind of on the fly? What do you need to know from them in order to help them find the best wine to go with their food?
Well, the first question that I always ask is, what kind of wines do you love? I mean, if somebody is, you know, really hates red wine, then I'm going to try to not find a giant bold Napa cab to go with their fish dish, I think. But at the end of the day, it's kind of, again, like listening to, because everyone has their own path and follows their own arc of how they appreciate wine. And so it's kind of like trying to get in tune with what is their palate like, and then just kind of find a way to kind of dovetail into that, but also maybe push them a little bit.
And that was another question I had, where if I go to a restaurant, I am very likely to order a Cab Sav because I know mm-hmm. I've had it. I know I like it. I know what to expect. And so I wonder if you have any tips for us that want to try to push our comfort zones a little bit without trying something we're going to absolutely hate.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think the best thing is to ask. I think in both going to restaurants and in going to retail shops, I mean, if you're visiting an independent business, their best possible thing they could hope for is to make you happy. So they're not going to, like, you know, try to shovel the same old stuff to you, right? So you'd be like, hey, you know what? I really love Cabernet Sauvignon. I want to tell the person you're working with, I want to explore other things. This is what I like about it. This is my price range. Is there something that you can suggest for me.
I also think it's important for the consumers to describe as any words you want. Don't feel like you can't. Whatever you taste, tell them that's what you taste, and use words. I mean, if you taste bell peppers or you want something that's more fruit and strawberry or you want an herbal note, like there's no wrong descriptors.
Yeah, the more descriptive you are, the better you can figure out what you want.
And I encourage people who want to learn about wine to go to a good wine store where, you know, there are dozens of them in Columbus and tell them sort of what you like, red or white, and buy a case of wine of different things that and be guided by the Somme or by the wine store and taste them. And slowly but surely you can sort of figure out what you like. Mm. Are you a red person all the time or do you like white wines?
Mm, yeah. Or are you asking me?
Mm-hmm.
I only like sweet white wines. Or so I love sparkling wines. So I will take I'll take a champagne, but usually it can't be too dry. And that's actually something else I wanted to talk about. You mentioned tannins and kind of the concept of acidity. There's also dry versus sweet. Is that right?
Yeah.
And then what are the other kind of
global flavors?
Yeah. What are the big words or the spectrums that you think about when you're thinking about wine? Body is another one, I believe.
Yeah. Yeah. So acidity is obviously, as we said, like what makes your mouth water. And that to me is the one of the most important things to pairing with a dish is having an appropriate level. Tannin
is... What about like terroir?
Well, yeah. Terroir is another great thing.
So let's explain what terroir is.
Well, that's to your first point about where it's grown and where it come from.
Yeah.
Terroir it means ground and it's where the grapes are from, correct?
Yeah. And I'll often ask people, okay, in a red wine, do you want a light red wine like a Pinot Noir? Mm-hmm. Do you like a medium-bodied... like a Rhone, Cote de Rhone, or a Rhone, or a big wine like Cabernet Sauvignon. At least you can get into the ballpark. I don't know if you...
Well, that's actually how we ended up organizing our wine lists, because I think that having so many wine lists, larger wine lists, can be really, really intimidating to the consumer because it's just a bunch of words and languages that I don't understand. And so that's where we ended up dividing the entire wine list into categories that I found that most consumers use when describing what they like. So there's a category that says full-bodied red wines. There's a category that's called the elegant side of red. There's a white wine category, which is crisp.
Good one.
So really, because most people end up describing wine in terms with adjectives. So we try to like – use those adjectives and then translate them into sort of the technical apparatus of acid and tannin and sweetness. And like I think dry wine is like one of the hardest things ever because there's like four different ways that people mean dry wine. And sometimes when they say dry wine, they don't mean dry wine. like, oh, I really like a nice dry wine. And it turns out that they like semi-sweet wines, which like Apothic or The Prisoner, which is totally fine. Like, again, like I'm happy if you're drinking wine and that's great. But so that's a kind of the fun part is trying to figure out this is what they mean and then finding something that they love. So for me, you know, you can just use some of those ground rules like, okay, so tannin likes protein and it likes fat. So that's one of the reasons why steak was always paired with Cabernet. Mm-hmm. Cabernet had lots of tannin. It's very full and rich and had big flavors to stand up against all of that intense flavor and all the fat of a beautiful cut of beef.
And what about natural wines?
I mean, I wish somebody would tell me what natural wine meant.
I was going to say, I don't know what natural wine means. Can you explain, Joshua?
I was letting you.
Oh, no. Yeah. It's,
little
well, I think it's pretty – I think natural wine is a pretty ill-defined concept. But as I understand it, natural wine is supposed to be minimal intervention where they don't want to add sulfites or some of the other preservatives that are often used in wine. And I find most natural wines tend to have a little bit more of a there's some complexity. There's definitely a little bit more bacteria, but so that also in it going
love
on.
Thinking
so
thinking about that when I'm thinking about what I'm consuming.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I think that you know, a few years ago, you know, shrubs were super popular, right? The vinegar based sodas were kind of in vogue in the cocktail community, and sour beers and the beer world are becoming popular.
Very true.
And I think that natural wine kind of dovetails into that because a lot of the natural wines kind of have a slight vinegar note.
Or is it more organic? Are we talking about organic? Because we go to a lot of wineries like Honig and then in the Rhone Valley. We've had – they're talking about – there's another term. I don't know if it's natural or organic, but they talk about
– biodynamic.
Biodynamic, maybe.
Biodynamic.
Yeah. Yeah.
So does it is it almost a crunchy thing? Like people who want to be closer to their food or want to be better for the earth will drink a natural wine?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is definitely an element to that where it's a little bit more of that. Slow food maybe.
Sure.
Like I think there's a lot of people who like slow food or are interested in the idea. But again, I think it's also been a young enough movement that, again, as I said, it's kind of ill-defined and people are trying to figure out what it means and why are we doing it.
Mm-hmm. We are talking about wine and food this hour on All Sides. It's Chefs in the City. With me as always, co-host Steve Stover, WOSU food critic, and our guest this hour, Joshua Dalton, the chef and owner of Veritas, and Gregory Stokes, the manager and sommelier. We will be right back to talk more about wine and food in just a moment on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Chefs in the City on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Claire Roth in for Ann today. Co-host Steve Stover is with me to discuss wine and food and also the latest restaurant news around Columbus. Also with us, our guest Gregory Stokes, the manager and sommelier at Veritas, and Joshua Dalton, the chef and owner there. Thank you both for staying with us.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So we've been talking a lot about talking to a sommelier about what sort of wine can go with food. But if you are without a sommelier, give us some tips on how to choose for our food. How do you decode a wine list when there's pages and pages of names you can't pronounce?
Well, ideally, I think if somebody has a wine list where there's pages and pages, they hopefully have someone who knows what they're doing. Otherwise, I think they're just trying to show off. So I think that would just get back to, again, drink what you like. Obviously, I think Josh and I agree that the best way to start your meal is before you can just get champagne and it'll pair with everything.
And not necessarily champagne, but something sparkling. Something.
Because champagne's from a specific region in France, but sparkling wine.
It just wakes up your palate. Says, hey, let's get ready to have some fun.
Why does it go with everything? I've read that multiple places, that champagne's a great way to start because it basically goes with everything. Why is that?
Well, I think it gets back to like the rules of structural pairing is how as I like to talk about it. It's an acidic wine, which means that, like, acid to me works with salt. So the champagne with potato chips is amazing. So like champagne, even texturally, right?
Like, seriously,
champagne with fried food is amazing. And so that also gets into like acid really likes fat. So again, squeeze of lemon onto like a fatty dish. I mean, it really just kind of does everything. I mean, I think you can have like a rosé champagne with a steak is amazing.
And I think in a place with a smaller wine list, I think, you know, you decide what you're going to order and then look at, you know, are you going to go red? Are you going to go white? Are you going to go bottles or going to glasses? All of those things play in. I like the wine pairings because they're fun and because the somm is excited because sometimes I'm assuming you don't always serve the same wine with the same dish with everybody. You might flip it around. I like Rhone wines. You might do a different wine pairing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's some guests that I've gotten to know very well and their preferences. And so sometimes there'll be a wine pairing and I'm like, all right, I know they don't like that. And so I'll make a substitution for them just on the fly. Just again, it's like trying to work within everyone's comfort zones and preferences.
Nice. Well, and you brought up an interesting question we haven't talked about yet, which is bottle versus glass. Any good kind of rules of thumb when it comes to deciding between those two? Presumably, you should know that you like a wine before you order a bottle of it.
Well, I have one bias. I don't care much for red wine that's been opened previously, like a day or or two more,
yeah.
unless you've got a system. Sure. I always try to finish my red wine when I open a bottle.
I'm sure that's
great
tough for
sacrifice,
you, Steve.
Yes. But, well, I guess.
I think, I mean, Wine by the Glass is a fantastic way to kind of explore without being committal, you know, and get into, like, you know, you don't get stuck with a whole bottle that you don't like.
Yeah.
And some of the really great restaurants, especially when I go to New York, every glass of wine that you order, they'll actually come and pour you a little
sample
before you actually have to commit to the glass.
And many places, or some, a few places even open a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing about it is that you can, just like I love small plates because, you know, Michael Mina says you get your most enjoyment out of a dish in five bites.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly with wine, although I don't usually do this, I do think that there's a great fun in trying different wines, particularly when you have a knowledgeable
palate
person guiding you along the way.
Now, I will say that, you know, buying a bottle of wine is, if you're going to drink that much, which I absolutely do, is the more cost-effective thing. I mean,
yeah.
The economics of restaurants, because, again, you know, you don't like glasses or bottles of wine that have been open for more than a day or two. That means we have to keep opening bottles and we're losing product. And so those generally per glass get marked up more. And so bottles typically, I mean, we try to encourage people to enjoy each other's company.
I think people also have to remember there's only four glasses in a bottle.
Yeah.
It's not that much.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah.
And also I'll just say what hasn't been opened today.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to hurt people.
Yeah.
Are there good beginner ones? If let's say I've never drank a glass of wine in my life, but I'd love to start to get to know wines. Are there good varieties that are good places to start that might be kinder on a new palate?
Yeah, I mean, I think in my experience, you know, everybody starts and ends with Riesling. Riesling is, I think, a wine that so many of us start our wine drinking journeys with, and then maybe we get into dry wines and dry whites, and then we get into dry reds, and eventually, if you drink wine long enough, you probably return to the place where you realize that sweet Riesling is probably still one of the greatest wines in the world.
Really, one of the greatest wines in the world.
It was the.
Why is that?
It's just a perfect harmony. I mean, no, it's like you bite into a peach. Like, a peach is delicious, and a good Riesling should just be like biting into a good juicy peach.
Wow.
I don't want to go back to where I started. It was Matus Rosé and Boone's Farm and
a little
like
Lancers.
That back in, yeah, Lancers and we call it Mateus Rosé.
Yeah.
So in the day.
Where else in town is a great place to get a good glass of wine and a wonderfully paired meal? If you're not eating at Veritas, where would you go?
I would say I don't drink a lot of wine around town. Not to say that there aren't great wine programs, but I think I just drink so much wine at work that I don't really do it that much. But I think that obviously Chris Dillma at the Refectory is doing a fantastic job.
The Refectory, you said?
Yeah.
Yep.
Where else would you go, Steve?
Well, I've had good wine a lot of different places, but I think Refectory would be my first choice for wine. I'm just trying to think of other wine programs.
Josh?
Well-priced.
I don't know. I know that Lawbird is about to open. That
yeah, Lawbird's going to be awesome.
Yeah,
I've seen their wine list. It looks really, really cool.
Are they having food?
Yes, they'll have food there.
And when do they open? It's on South High Street.
Yeah,
by the way.
I was talking to them a few days ago. I think they're doing their soft open this weekend, and they should be officially open next weekend. But well, I mean, we'll see. But obviously, opening restaurants, nothing ever happens on time.
On time. We've been talking so much this hour about your expertise as a sommelier, but I'd love to hear a little bit about how you actually garner that expertise. A lot of folks would say, wow, his job is perfect. He drinks wine all day, but I'm sure it is more than just pouring and sipping. Tell us how you gain that sort of knowledge base.
Yeah, I mean, usually my funny quip for saying, how do you learn about wine so much? Is like, well, I drink a lot. But to be honest, it's just a lot of reading and memorizing maps and flashcards. And so I kind of got onto the sommelier track, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago when I really decided that like wine is what I wanted to do and I wanted to learn about it. And so once I kind of dedicated myself to this is what I'm going to do and started going through the Court of Master Sommeliers, which is sort of this independent accrediting body. I mean, it really doesn't mean anything. Like, there's no degree, there's no school that you go to, but it's
It's huge.
It's huge. And there's a body of professionals
all over the world. There are only
basically
a relatively few people.
Yeah,
like
I think
master chefs.
Like 230 master sommeliers in the world right now.
Just 230 across the globe.
Might be a few more now. I can never keep
that's
track.
That's wild.
But so it's basically a community of them that get together and say, you know what, we're going to help try to boost the education level, and so we're going to administer these tests. So you basically just study your heart out for years, and then fork over a little bit of money and take the test, and hopefully you do well. But I think the most important thing is, obviously, even if you don't pass, you've grown as a professional. Because again, as we talked about, there's so much wine in the world now, and you as a consumer have so many questions. And so our job is to, even if not know the answer, be able to point you in the right direction. And so, yeah, it's, you know,
teaching. There's a lot of teaching.
It's all teaching. I have students that I teach every week who are trying to learn more. And so,
where do you teach?
Usually at my dining room table.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes at Veritas. I ended up going through the court. I passed the advanced exam on my first try a few years ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And so now I've been sitting for the Master Sommelier exam. I passed the theory exam this year. So pretty excited about that. I have tasting and service next year. But, I mean, really what it comes down to is for this exam, I made and memorized about 9,000 flashcards.
Wow. How many hours do you think you spent studying?
I don't know. I'm not really great at math. Probably 3 hours a day, 6 days a week for the last 4 years.
Oh, my gosh.
Whoa.
That is quite a commitment.
So, yeah. I mean, it was a lot. But now I feel like, again, even like I just feel like I kind of grew. And, of course, it almost feels like that Socrates thing that now that I know a lot, I realize I don't know anything at all.
Very much.
We're lucky to have both of you in Columbus, really.
No.
Josh and Greg, you guys are doing a fabulous job, and there's a reason why you're number one in Columbus and have been four out of the last 6 years or so.
So I want to be able to talk about restaurant news before we finish up. Steve, what are some of the notable openings that we have seen so far in this autumn?
Well, first of all, a reminder that we do have a bunch of restaurant reviews on the blog. I'm going to give you a new address because right now it's under construction, but go to wosu.org/blogs and then hit on Chefs in the City. But anyway, we have, I'm guessing, close to 200 reviews over the year. But the new ones that we have, Rich Terrapack did So Plated, which is on in Lane Avenue.
And that's S-O-W Plated.
Yep. And I have Seesaw is Up Today. The new restaurant from Jonathan Sawyer, the James Beard Award-winning chef from Cleveland.
What sort of food is there?
It is eclectic, modern. There's a lot of wood-fired effort going on there.
Ah, yeah.
And everything from a scallop crudo with a little shot of mezcal to an interesting deconstructed Caesar salad to a wonderful boned-out chicken breast or chicken half chicken that is cooked over at the wood fire.
And that's the first open flame restaurant in Columbus, isn't it?
Oh, no. There are a lot. Three wood-fired restaurants opening. Seesaw. Let's see. Who else is wood-fired? Matt and Tony's Wood-Fired Kitchen and Sono Wood-Fired, Chicago-based, which will be out at Easton. So those are just three now. And there are a number of others. And then the Old Spot, Rick Lopez's new gastro pub. And then, of course, I do a monthly review of restaurant news, so that should be up there too. Anyway, busy summer, at least one new restaurant a week, it seemed like, this summer. Seesaw, the Old Spot, Fireproof in the Short North, and Gamut Beer Garden in Old Town East are some of them. Also this summer, Reball, a Cleveland street food kitchen or organic non-GMC, opened at Bridge Park. And then a sister restaurant called Town Hall. There's a new building.
What does Cleveland street food mean before we move on? Is it from Cleveland originally? Is it like a
taco from
truck?
Cleveland, and I think it's street food.
Okay, I was going to say, what's
organic?
What's
no
Cleveland?
Comment
what's a classic
on my notes.
Cleveland food?
But Town Hall. Anyway, the Moxie's, a new hotel that opened in the Short North at 800 North High Street. And they're going to have a rooftop bar, one of now two dozen at least on the top. And Town Hall is a Cleveland-based, 100% non-GMO and mostly organic restaurant they purport to cater to everybody, vegan, vegetarian, low glycemic, ketogenic, and paleo. So go figure, but it's going to be in that building. So that's two Cleveland restaurants opening. And Matt and Tony's Wood-Fired Kitchen from Pat and Gracie's recently opened in the CBC, the Columbus Brewing Company space down in the Brewery District. The Pearl, another Cameron Mitchell, is going to open up in Dublin.
I love the Pearl.
Kitchen Social from the former Bravo Brio folks is going to open at the Point in Polaris. Something called Ivan, I don't know much about this, but Ivan Kane's 40 Deuce, a bistro-style restaurant and speakeasy at Easton.
I feel like speakeasies are becoming more popular.
Yes.
I feel like we're seeing
in
more
other
of those
places like Nashville,
matchsticks.
There are a lot of them.
Yeah.
And so, as I said, there's a lot of wood-fired food and rooftop bars that are going on.
Which a funny season for them, right?
I'm excited to note that the Preston's, the food truck and pop-up burger joint, Preston's, a burger joint, is going to open their first brick-and-mortar outlet on Cherry Street, just west. It's just west of downtown, between Rich and Main, next spring. That's from the same folks, Katie Randazzo and Matt Higgins of Ambrose and Eve, and then some other people are involved. A guy named Reed Wolger and Bake Me Happy's Letha Pugh, they've created and they plan to open several of these Preston's burger joints. I'm excited about Blend Cafe, which is it's open. It's the one of the two restaurants that are going to go into the new Mitchell Hall at Columbus State.
The new Bud
It's a bakery
Dairy.
Cafe.
The Mitchell Hall.
No, the Mitchell Hall.
And the Bud Dairy Hall. Is that open now?
Bud Dairy is not open yet, but they've named all 10 of their – 9 or 10 of their people. In my blog, I think we've listed them all, but we'll – maybe next month we'll put together the whole list because it's very eclectic.
And it's going to open pretty soon, I think.
Early next year.
Okay.
There's some existing restaurants like Bonifacio who have a place and others who have small places or pop-ups. So there'll be 9 people. There'll be a common area like in any food hall and obviously adult beverages. And then you just go to one or another or all grazing and enjoy the food. But then this is Mitchell Hall at Columbus State,
mm-hmm.
and this bakery cafe is open. And then they're going to have a new full-service restaurant that basically it goes along – it's going to be kid-driven or student-driven.
Really? Okay.
And, no, there'll be adult supervision, but it'll be open mostly college hours. Do we have time? Harvest Pizza, which closed in German Village in April, is going to open a new larger store over in the Brewery District where Westies used to be on South Front, just north of Greenlawn. Matt Barbie, who was a guest on our show not long ago, who owns Rock Mill Tavern, has expanded his brewery operation, putting in a big new 1,500-square-foot tasting room, an outdoor live fire theater, and they're going to be able to do larger catering and weddings and things like that. Flatiron Tavern is reopened under different ownership. It's in the iconic Flatiron building on East Nationwide Boulevard, which was the home of Flatiron, which is one of my favorite places for almost 30 years. But it's a new menu. It's described as Philly cheesesteak-centric, I think. But it's appetizers, salads, and sandwiches. Natalie's Music Hall is opening a second location at, on Fifth Avenue, on King Avenue, in the old King Avenue 5 space. And the chef is exciting. Bradley Balch, who was the opening chef at Sycamore, then opened his own restaurant called Trillium.
Closed
a couple months ago in the old Elena space near campus, is going to be the chef at this second Natalie's.
Okay, we've only got a minute, so one more.
Let's see. Watershed Distillery owners are coming up with an interesting pork producing where they're going to grow heirloom pork varieties or Berkshire pork and serve them at restaurants and things. So a couple closings, Harvey and Ed's. Little Eater.
Little Eater closed their Clintonville location. Using it as a kitchen now. Yeah. Thank you guys both, Gregory Stokes and Joshua Dalton of Veritas. Thank you so much for coming on the program today.
Yeah, our pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And of course, co-host Steve Stover, thanks for being here as always. This has been Chefs in the City on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Claire Roth in for Ann today. Find all of our shows online at WOSU.org/allsides. Have a great weekend.